This week's episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 27th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Section D, in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. As sunny skies hit London this week, we've got a spring in our step here at Midori House. It's a spring that sprung us all the way to San Francisco, with a brief stopover in Iceland, taking in the new and the old, the small and the bold of the design industry. So let's waste no time in getting started. Coming up in part two of my interview with British architect John Pawson, he takes me through his surprising career trajectory.
You know, I walked into places and some felt good and some didn't. And of course, I've since realised that the ones that felt good are architecture and the ones that don't probably are buildings.
We drop in on the studio of Ohio Design in San Francisco, the firm that furnishes the offices for some of the legendary local startups.
Jake in Berlin texted Henrik, who's the head of the San Francisco office, go over to David's studio, he's having a warehouse sale. Henrik came over, bought a ton of stuff for his house, said, hey, we're doing this office, you want to come take a look? Now we're designing their whole office. That's the kind of projects we love.
And we take a pew in London's store Viaduct to hear how chair designs have inspired a variety of menus.
Everybody is wanting to create their own sort of individuality around their dining table, and I think that is a direct reflection on the kind of food that people are wanting to serve.
All that, plus we hop over to Iceland to see how the design community in Reykjavik is shaping up. We sit down with gallerist Rabbi Haj to talk through the DTANC design market report. And we've even got time for a bit of a song and a dance. That's all to come in the next hour here on Section D on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. In last week's episode of Section D, I sat down in Studio 2 of Midori House with architect John Pawson. Such was the fun that we had during our interview, it stretched way beyond the decent length of time for just one programme. So this week I bring you part two of our chat. Last week we spoke about Pawson's new book for Fiden, A Visual Inventory. This week we delve a little deeper into his career as an architect. Well, maybe now's a good time to talk a little bit about how you came to be an architect, because sort of doors were opened quite extraordinarily to you when you went to Japan, didn't you, and Shiro Kuramata sort of took you under his wing. Is that the best way of describing it?
Well, I think that I never thought I could be an architect. I mean, at school they said you had to do maths. My father later said, you employ architects, why would you want to be one if you can employ one? And then somebody else said, well, you need to read books, Pawson. And so I always thought design was something that other people did, you know, just like composing music. I thought it, you know, I couldn't do it. So I had this sort of, you know, reluctance. But I'd always in my mind been building up this idea of kind of architecture that I liked, or spaces that I would like to be in, or rooms that I'd like to do in my head. And one day I was in Japan and I was just leafing through a book in a bookshop, and I hadn't heard of Shiro Kuramata, but I opened the book and I was absolutely amazed, because here was a complete book about everything that was in my head, and no one else had actually visualized it for me before. I mean, of course, Mies van der Rohe is the absolute ultimate in a sense of simple architecture and the most exquisite possible. But he was from another age, you know, from me. But here was Kuramata, a sort of contemporary or vaguely contemporary. So I was incredibly excited. And, of course, being young and I suppose rather
precocious,
cocky or... Yes, or something. I mean, I don't know. I mean, now I'd die. I mean, I wouldn't dream of ringing up somebody I didn't know and saying, hey, you know, can we have coffee? You know, I mean, people do it to me.
How do you respond when someone does that to you?
Well, probably with extreme resistance. I mean, we have glass doors on the office in King's Cross, and occasionally we do get stalkers or people that won't leave. until at least they get some sort of thing. And I am sympathetic, but on the other hand, I'm slightly wary. I mean, thank God Kuramata didn't think I was completely mad.
No. So he did, he met you for coffee, and that was the...
Well, it started a friendship, and, yeah. And then I used to hang around his office, and I think he got very frustrated, or fed up, rather, with me, because, and said, why don't you go and do architecture yourself, rather than...
Watching
follow
me do
me.
It.
Oh, yes, and, you know, and he said, I've heard that, you know, there's a very good school in London called the AA, the Architectural Association, why don't you go there? So I did. I literally left Japan almost immediately and went to the... Although I didn't really survive at the AA. It was very tough. The big thing for me was that I'd finally, after a long time, found something out that I was really passionate about, and also that I had a certain facility. I mean, I tried other careers. And architecture is about, you know, it's a physical feeling and it's a sort of visceral thing and it's about atmosphere and it's how you feel. And that's why I got into architecture in the first place, because, you know, when I was young, you know, I walked into places and some felt good and some didn't. And of course, I've since realized that the ones that felt good are architecture and the ones that don't probably are buildings. I'm never really satisfied. I mean, that's the big problem about being a perfectionist, because you're never happy, and the glass is always completely empty. Yeah. I mean, the office is full of empty empty cups, you know.
I mean, going to some of your work, the Cistercian monastery, people held up as sort of being the sort of signature building that you have created, but also you've done at the other end of the spectrum a lot of work for Calvin Klein.
Well, I did a series of their stores, yeah, for the company, and then I've done some of Calvin Klein's personal, you know, his apartment and his house and things like that. I think people find it in some way, how can you build for, you know, mammon and build for God? The thing is that you know, we're architects and we, of course, we build around the way people live and the way people work. But you're building buildings. It's very, very important what happens inside them, but you're not in control of that. You design them as best you can. And, you know, in terms of Calvin Klein, you want people to feel good when they go in the store. You want the clothes to look good. That is not a temple. But if you're designing a church, the big difference is that when it's finished, you're hoping that it has a sacred atmosphere and a spiritual one. And that then makes it conducive to, you know, to getting closer to God, which is what the job's about. But the monks are, you know, of course, are an extraordinary bunch of people, but they are, you know, very pragmatic. They want an architect who can give them what they want and understands what's appropriate. But it's a building for them. I mean, they're not expecting me to be pure in character and pure in person. Or there were no interviews about my Christianity or, you know, and I'm not Catholic. I mean, it's they want somebody to do the job, and it, you know, it's about putting up a building, you know, that has something special about it.
What kind of relationship do you have with monks now? Do you stay in touch, or is that a commission that's kind of ended once you handed it over to them?
No, commissions never end. I mean, the reason I love order so much is that my brain is so messy. But to help me, I have lists in the office, and they're illustrated lists. So I have a to-do list which has a picture of every job I'm working on, and the architect that's helping with that. And then I have something called to monitor, which is a list where projects go when there's an idea that they might be finished, or at least the money stops coming in and the clients moved in. But you never part company. I mean, the church at the monastery was consecrated in 2004, and we're still building there, and we still go, just as I still visit, you know, the house in Los Angeles, and that was finished several years ago. I mean, it's sort of forever.
You've said a couple of times that you're a perfectionist, and I wonder what it's like then for the next big high-profile commission that you're working on, which is to convert the Commonwealth Institute into the new design museum. How do you approach a project like that where you're essentially sort of taking on something that exists and turning it into something different.
Well, I'm a perfectionist, but of course I'm far from perfect. I mean, I love perfection, and that's kind of what I get a lot of people to help me with. Since people began to live in places and not live outside, you know, that you've always adapted to things that already exist as well. Having a clean slate or building from scratch is of course part of architecture, but a lot of work is done in learning from existing buildings and then, you know, retuning them, you know, for life today. And we have this extraordinary thing where we've got the chance to inhabit the old Commonwealth Institute, you know, which is an iconic, you know, post-war modernist building that was finished in 62, which has, allows us this extraordinary space in the middle of Holland Park. So you know, you're starting off with a great site to begin with. Of course, it's not what I would have done, but, you know, you've got a fantastic box with an interesting skin, and then you've got this amazing roof, which is called a hyperbolic paraboloid. So when you get up to the top floor and you look up, in parts, the ceiling is 16 metres above you, which is, I don't know, 50 or 60 feet above you. So it's a long way up. And then if you look down, it's about the same to the ground floor. So, I mean, normally when you get to the top floor of a building, say like the one we're in, you know, the ceiling is near you, but if you look down the staircase, you know, it's a long way down. So you've got this extraordinary sort of half-half thing. And I'm, you know, I've got free rein inside, so, you know, to open it up and enjoy the roof and try and get all the spaces. But in the end, make it so that it's, I suppose, fit for the design museum to be the best one in the world and to focus on looking at stuff. Which is an interesting thing for me, actually.
I know, I was going to say, because, I mean...
A museum full of things.
Full of things, and...
But full of people, and a public place. Too. I mean, it's great for me to have a place which people will be able just to pop in, even if it's just to use the loo, you know.
That was John Paulson with me in Studio 2 last week. And from the sanctity of Studio 2, we head to one of the quieter countries on the Nordic design scene. Iceland has nothing like the mighty heritage or contemporary clout in design circles compared to its sibling Nordic states of Denmark, Sweden, or even Norway. But this might be about to change. It's currently holding a design week to promote its homegrown young community. Amy Gutman headed to Reykjavik to talk to the key players and find out what it's all about.
I'm Greipur Gíslason, and I'm the festival director of Design Mart in Reykjavik.
Is that an active seafood warehouse?
It's an active one. Not as like as for seafood though, but during our festival, Design Mart designers have been, from the very beginning really, when we started the festival, moving in or settling in into empty slots, empty houses, warehouses, shops even, to like exhibit, because they maybe have their workshops at home or whatever, so they want to exhibit their things, what they're doing, somewhere that people can come and see it. So, for example, during the first Design March in 2009, in March obviously, that was like just a few months after the financial crash in Iceland. Lot and the Christmas was over, so the Christmas shopping was over. Lots of shops in the main street had like closed down. So designers filled up every space in the main shopping street downtown with like all kinds of design. And that had been kind of the spirit of the march since. People are trying to find empty houses to put up huge exhibitions, which is really, really interesting and nice, I would say. So this house here is known as the fishing net factory or workshop maybe. It has like been housing all kinds of activities. Lots of like our most prominent designers are in this shop. So, and this is just in the heart of the fish packing district.
Okay, shall we go inside?
We can go.
We continue talking inside the Design Collective, housing a shop and restaurant. I ask Griper about the difficulty of living in the shadow of Scandinavia's well-established design community.
I think almost everyone would say that 12 years ago, 10 years ago, the design department or faculty of the Academy of the Arts in Iceland was founded. That must have been like a huge page turner for the design community in Iceland. Until then, people had to move out of the country to do design. So the design community wasn't really a community, because when people came back, no one knew it. No one knew each other from the design field. That has changed historically. Then 4 years ago, designers in Iceland founded what they call the Iceland Design Center, where I work. And that also have brought together the designers from different fields, all the way from fashion to architects. That also made a community that wasn't before. So there has been, with no doubt, a design boom in some sort for the last decade in Iceland. Also during the last years, Icelandic design have come to fashion in Iceland, that it may be weren't. One reason for that is that during our financial crash in the late 2008, everything that was Icelandic became a little bit more sought after in Iceland, because the nation became aware of how necessary it was to try to keep as much of the work in the country and not move the currency or like the valuta like out of it, you know, all these things. Like, so Icelandic design, Icelandic craft, Icelandic food, everything became a little bit more like it came in to buy Icelandic.
Presumably, once the crisis hit, nobody had any money. So what was happening in the retail sector, and did that give way at all for emerging designers?
The big crash is in like late 2008, October. We talk about, early October. But it was like a huge downfall, like in the months after Christmas. And for example, lots of stores closed down in downtown Reykjavik, which helped us doing the design march in March 2009, since we could fill it up with design and like as pop-up galleries really for design. And I think also people lost their jobs, you know. Work on design became a little bit more better, in a sense. There were designers doing other things, but lost their jobs, architects or whatever, that now could be a little bit more creative or work on more interesting things in a way, their own things maybe.
Arni Perarensdottir is an architect and designer at the Collective. She's hoping to benefit from Griper's work and the upcoming design march. We talk about what it's like being a designer in such a young community.
I would say that there are very good things to be a designer in Reykjavik. You have like this small networking, and you have easy ways to, you know, connect to people, because also the country is very small. But there are also not so good side of it. We have not so many opportunities. You know, there are like not so many producers of the things, and we have like small manufacturers, and you know, I would say that would be the downside of it. I learned in Denmark to be an architect, and then we came here like just almost few minutes to before the collapse. So that was quite an adventure.
What was it like returning home and trying to start a creative business in the midst of a crash?
Yeah, I mean, that was hard, but at the same time, the community and the people were really open for Icelandic design, Icelandic manufacture, produced in Iceland stuff. Right after the crisis, it was very, you know, open for everybody. It was like, now we have to stand together, now we have to, you know, buy Icelandic. And
is it quite difficult to be taken seriously compared to sort of, you know, the Scandinavian sisters, as it were?
I mean, we have a really short history of design, of course, and compared to, for example, Denmark. Young people are really into, you know, buying old Danish furniture and stuff, and we don't have that here. But we have this new, fresh things, and the designers are ready to do almost anything, you know, to, you know, promote themselves. And we are not even teenagers. We are compared to grown-ups, design communities. But of course, you have to be optimistic. We see a lot of opportunities.
Griper Gustafsson also sees opportunities.
The Iceland Design Center opened its traveling exhibition in Helsinki this December. And the managing director there said to us that during the last years, Iceland and Icelandic designers have really been like getting a place or taking some space in the Scandinavian design scene. And I think that was pretty much the nicest thing he could say, because I think that's what we have been trying to, or willing to, or aiming for behind the scenes, or almost without knowing it, that we want to be talked about in the same sense or the same sentence or at the same time as the Scandinavian design. We don't have any huge, there are no huge design names in Iceland that would be world known, but we're working on that.
With a little luck and the spirit of the financial crisis, Arni Pararinsdóttir could be one of them. For Monocle in Reykjavik, I'm Amy Gutman.
Time for a short break now, but stay with us. We'll be hearing how chairs have inspired some mighty menus after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Section D. Food for Thought is a new exhibition that opened this week at Viaduct in London. It explores the relationship between design and food. It's not about good cutlery and crockery, though. Instead, Viaduct's owner, James Mayer, cooked up the idea of approaching local chefs in the vicinity to each devise a menu based around a different chair in his shop. We sent our reporter, Hazel Pfeiffer, along to tuck in.
It all started with eating and seating. The link between food and chairs may not be immediately apparent, but as we mostly sit down to eat, chairs become central to our dining experience. With this in mind, founder of Viaduct James Mayer invited three local chefs to put their creative juices to the test and devise 15 menus inspired by some of the world's most famous design classics. Sam Clark of Morrow, Fergus Henderson of St. John, and Mike Belbin of The Eagle all rose to the challenge with some intriguing results. I caught up with James at his Clerkenwell showroom to talk street furniture, creative thinking, and barbecued chair.
The actual exhibition is a catalyst of thinking how there are links between architecture, food, creativity, design, community. And I think that when you start exploring this, there are so many threads where each can help the other. For example, then as soon as you start exploring urban gardening, guerrilla gardening, which are all for the benefit of a local community, there are great creative approaches to that. Street food, how can street architecture help with the culture of street food? Why do people end up grabbing a box of food and then taking it back to their office? Why isn't there more street furniture just so people can stop for 20 minutes and have a chat? So the impacts are huge across the area, and I hope that this exhibition will begin to stir a few ideas up for everybody.
So how has food changed the landscape here in Clerkenwell over the past few years?
When I moved here ages ago, there was really a local Italian restaurant and the Eagle and not much else. now you've seen, as again this is part of this designers beginning to change a community. First of all, it was lots of architects and designers around here. The Guardian was here, Face was here, so there was more and more creative people, and they were kind of clearly up for more interesting things to eat at lunchtime. So gradually it evolved, and now there's an incredible choice of restaurants around here, and also in Exmouth Market, the street food. So this has a really interesting impact on the local community and bringing life to what was actually a very nice but slightly quiet backwater.
So there's been a backlash to overly embellished food recently and kind of a return to more simple, more rustic styles. So how do you see the new relationship between food and design?
From a furniture point of view, that's been very interesting recently is that because of the recession, because of the way things have been going in the world, that people have wanted a more homely approach. So dining tables, wooden tables are wanted, that the chairs are slightly more conventional, or they're design classics like Eames chairs or Saarinen ones that are then paired with a wooden table. So everybody is wanting to create their own sort of individuality around their dining table, and I think that is a direct reflection on the kind of food that people are wanting to serve.
So which is your favourite menu?
Oh, that's a really tricky one, but I think that in many ways that the favourite example is the Houdini chair by Stefan Dietz, and Sam Clark from Morrow likened it to a barbecue. He did add that it should all be done very lovingly, but the idea would be to use the chair itself as the barbecue and set and place some salmon on the seat and then set fire to it and smoke the salmon within the chair.
What did you say to that?
I loved it as an idea. I don't know whether the designer or the manufacturer would be that thrilled, but it just shows that the way that creative thinking can go off on complete tangents, and I think that's really exciting.
At the launch party on Thursday, the crowd were getting into the swing of things.
I'm Jack Mummer, and I'm the creative director for Philips Design Probes.
So what do you think about the exhibition?
I was really intrigued by the idea, because linking food and seating is a very obvious thing in a way, but it's never been highlighted like this before. And I think bringing it together like this in the way that it's been done and getting the chefs to consider and react to the chair in a more kind of sort of spontaneous way, I think is really fantastic. It's really, really interesting.
Hi, I'm Suzanne. I work with Surface Architects. Obviously, some of the chairs have more nostalgic themes associated with them, like the plastic kind of beach chair, that people each have their own memories of certain things, which is quite similar to like the Madeleine in Marcel Proust and the way in which, you know, a certain taste or something invokes another reaction. I think that's quite interesting.
Jose Estevez de Matos from de Matos Ryan Architects. They're kind of very witty, to the point culinary experiences, and I think they're very astute.
Did you have a favourite?
Hiroshima by Naoto Fukasawa, and I like the way Fergus Henderson says it reminds him of squid sushi. Always looks tempting but somewhat unsatisfactory in the chew. Slightly disagree, I think it's a very comfortable chair.
The visitors were clearly inspired by the chef's imagination, but what was it like creating a menu from a chair? I asked Sam Clark of Morrow about the creative process.
First of all, I thought it was quite eccentric, and I couldn't really relate to the idea of food and beautifully designed chairs. But then the more I sort of started thinking about it, the more it became quite a fun project, and actually there was quite a lot to say.
The Eames Eiffel chair reminds you of the Eiffel Tower and Mother's Milk. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I actually didn't know when I wrote the piece that it was known as the Eiffel Tower chair. But it did remind me of the Eiffel Tower. So it reminded me of a time when I went up the Eiffel Tower, and as I was coming down, just got into the elevator, the lift started plummeting to the ground, and my life started flashing before my eyes in that cliched way. But luckily, I only got as far as my mother's milk. It was a very short plummet. And the chair has these Eiffel Tower legs, but then this beautiful sort of milky, soft quality. And so the two made me think of that split second.
Has it made you look at chairs differently?
I love design anyway, and you know, they're so cleverly designed, so pared down to the essence of the sort of perfect chair, but they're all so incredibly different that I just have huge respect for the designers, because they look so simple, but you realise how good as a designer you have to be to make something that simple. And yeah, I do appreciate the designers and have huge respect for them.
Last night, a number of creative minds came together at Viaduct to further explore the connections between food and design. Designer Daniel Charney talked about the industrialization of food production, while guerrilla gardener Rebecca Hossack shared her crusade of bringing greenery to Fitzrovia. Urban designer Ewan Mills summed up the evening by explaining how food was central to his recent work on the rejuvenation of Chatsworth High Street.
Rents have doubled in the last year. So whilst that's good, property owners are very, very happy, but a lot of these smaller independent shops are now kind of really struggling. I mentioned the marginal businesses are really, really struggling. How is food related to this? But then I realised it's about cafes, it's about restaurants, it's about markets. I had never actually seen this as related to food in any way. I'm a town planner, I'm not much of a food connoisseur, but it does seem to work. You don't realise how important it actually is, and it's this thread that kind of seems to run through everything. And what's really interesting is how you can see that food is just one aspect of this much more complex ecosystem. It's got planning is one aspect, property is another aspect, community involvement is another aspect, entertainment, and there's all these different aspects that make up high streets. I'm sure all of you live near some sort of high street or they operate in shops, and I'd implore you, get involved and really take a close look at it.
For Monaco in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
That was Hazel Pfeiffer at new exhibition Food for Thought in London's Viaduct. And if that has your taste buds tingling, here's a song for you. This is Hungry by Kusheen. Are you hungry? That was Kusheen with Hungry. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Last week, I was in San Francisco, a city very dear to my heart. It's not just about teenage billionaires and tech startups, though. It's also home to America's burgeoning maker movement. I popped into the studio of one man who's at the heart of the city's local manufacturing scene. David Pierce founded Ohio Design in 2000 and today runs a growing business from his mission-based workshop. He opened up his studio last Saturday to tell me more. So what I'm really interested in is the fact that you've designed and produced the furniture for quite a few of the tech startups in the city.
Yes.
How did you get involved in that?
Through architects. As I'm trained as an architect and I'm trained locally at Berkeley, we have a lot of friends that are still in architecture here and are so specifying us. And word of mouth, really, to this point, has been word of mouth. We just sent out our first newsletter last month, so we're starting to do outreach. We have our database organized now and everything. So we're starting to kind of reach out to people, and that's our goal, to reach more people and the most people. But we've been very lucky with word of mouth. If somebody orders a piece for their home, they say, oh, you do commercial as well. So they'll order something for their office as well.
And what kind of clients have you been working for then?
Through an interior designer named Lauren Jeremiah. We did Path, Causes, Dropbox. We've done a lot of work since, and we're still continuing to do work for Dropbox. Sunrun, and that's not through Lauren, but did Method, Vast, which is another kind of, they manage a bunch of websites, mostly around car. We are doing the local office for SoundCloud, and that's through a friend of mine in Berlin. Mm-hmm. My wife's from Berlin, and so SoundCloud is based in Berlin, and they have a San Francisco office because a lot of their apps are designed here. So we literally, Jake in Berlin, texted Henrik, who's the head of the San Francisco office, go over to David's studio, he's having a warehouse sale. Henrik came over, bought a ton of stuff for his house at the warehouse sale, and then said, hey, we're doing this office, you want to come take a look? Came and take a look, now we're designing their whole office. That's the kind of projects we love.
But that's amazing, and I mean, this is something that it seems very unique to San Francisco. In fact, first of all, there are so many startups, and every startup needs an office, and when they grow at the rate that so many of them do here, the offices grow too. But also that they can go around the corner and speak to the man who's not just going to sort out their furniture, but make it by hand.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an amazing sort of mutually beneficial sense of community.
Yeah.
I mean, the furniture that you build, maybe we should talk a little bit about that. It's very...
Sure.
pared down. You mentioned before it's modernist.
Yes.
Why do you think these companies like having that in their offices?
One of the reasons that I love minimalism or modernism is because it is so simple and clean and clear, and it's quiet visually. And so, you know, I just like that idea of, I mentioned in the tour earlier, I'd rather see the flowers on a bookshelf or a table than the table itself. And so if the less detail that we can, if we have our choice to add detail or take it away, we always try to take it away. And so I would say, even in from the residential point of view, that works well for me. But even at the office, that also works well. So if you could have a visually quiet office and be focusing on, you know, if there is artwork, you focus on the artwork and not the table. There are some offices that like really poppy colors, and that's their brand. And we can speak to that too. We just did Hot Studios, and we made 8 different tables, 8 different colors. All the top was high gloss white and used as a whiteboard, but the base was all, you know, bright pink, bright blue, bright purple, yellow, and that spoke to their brand. But for me, the reduction of the things that serve you is really my goal.
Did you grow up in Ohio?
Yes.
And that's hence the name of the brand?
Correct, yeah. So when I was starting the company, 97, I didn't want to name it something super fancy. I don't, you know, numbers and fancy letter, like Z2 or A1 or whatever. I did have a cafe called A2 for a while, but it was only because Atlas was the first one and the A2 was the second.
Okay.
But anyway, so the Ohio, I was trying to think of a name. It didn't want to be David Pierce Studios. That seemed egocentric and very kind of limited in some ways. And so I was thinking about words that were in my life, and Ohio was part of that. And Ohio as a word is a very beautiful word. It's round and it's square, the H and the I in the middle. It's symmetrical at some level, but not quite. It actually can flip upside down if the graphics are the right way, and our logo actually can flip upside down and be read horizontal and vertical. So it has this real kind of multi-use, which does in some ways speak to what we do, because our tables can be workstations, or they can be resold from a commercial company. This is something that I didn't mention before. So a table that we'll design, if it's very, very simple in a commercial office, that could actually be a dining table. And it can go home and be resold. And if we design something that's timeless, and generally that's simple in style and high quality, it's going to stand the test of time aesthetically and hold its value. And so for these startup companies, that's one of our pitches, actually, is that you're not getting something at IKEA. You're not getting a cubicle. The last project we did, we had to rip out 40,000 square feet of cubicles, and they were worthless. The people that took them basically were going to recycle them, and they were only 7 or 8 years old.
Something else I wanted to ask you about
is
you employ 12 people at the moment, should you say?
Yep.
And how much more can you sort of produce and manufacture without having to upscale massively in terms of move locations?
That's a very good question.
Keep control over.
Yeah, a very good question. I think that I would guess that it's going to be about a year where we're going to outgrow. We have 7,000 square feet now, and we have to have some little retail component to it here. And we finished the building to be very beautiful once we clean it up and take it away from that production facility.
But is it important for you that you do stay local?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That you do have that open door policy of,
yes,
I can sell one chair to a family, but I can also sell 100 desks to a company.
Absolutely. And we are just starting to really get into the numbers on what is profitable and what is not. And so doing installations, we're not really set up for that. So can we find a company that will do installations for us, possibly? Mm-hmm. So that's a way that we might be able to grow without actually adding more people. What I'm thinking right now is we're probably going to need about 20,000 square feet in a year or a year and a half. And I would guess that we're going to, I'm not sure how big it'll grow. I'd like to get to $10 million. That's the first goal, $10 million gross revenue. And then step back and say, okay, is this a good quality? And we're going to keep it at this level? Or are we going to try to reach more people? Or what's the, you know, as you go forward, you start to see different paths open up. And I'm just at this point now where a few new paths are opening up, and we're kind of making some decisions which way we go.
That was me with David Pierce of Ohio Design in San Francisco's Mission District. And from the breezy, sunny east coast of America, it's time to head back to London after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Section D. Back from San Francisco and into Studio 2, this time with London gallerist and stalwart of the local design scene, Rabbi Haj. His firm, D-Tank, has just released its second market report for collectible design, a comprehensive survey of all the design auction houses, collated and analysed to evaluate the market. I began by asking him what the difference is between his findings this year compared to last.
The big difference is that it's basically the confirmation of the end of the contemporary collectible design in the auction room, unfortunately.
Really?
Yes.
So does that mean someone like Zaha Hadid has no...
Yes, the market is much more difficult, yes, for Zaha Hadid or even Ron Arad. They are selling much less than they used to sell 3 and 5 years ago.
And why is that? I mean, obviously there was a bubble 3 or 5 years ago, but...
It's exactly for that, because of the bubble, actually, because of this overrating the contemporary, but also because of the little bit of more the cautiousness of the collectors today. And this is the other confirmation. The collectors are buying, which we had this confirmation last year already, but this year it's been again, you know, they approved the case. Collectors are looking more for established names or pieces with historical names and good pedigrees and very good, you know, background information and research done on the pieces that are coming to auction. So the collector is much more picky.
Now, also in the market is the D-Tank Top 100, which is a list of the top designers who sold in 2011. And it's interesting because, I mean, it's scanning through them, I can recognise a lot of names from certainly the Phillips Grandmaster's sale in New York. Do you look at all the auction houses and think Phillips is the one that manages to push design better than Sotheby's or Christie's?
They are doing all of them a very good job. Phillips have tried to push contemporary design at the beginning of the 2000s. And they are a little bit more adventurous in a way than other auction houses, definitely. And the way they curate their auctions is very interesting. It's around a theme. But I have noticed that all other auction houses are following. So really the lead of Phillips is getting now a little bit shorter, and other auction houses are also doing the same thing as them now. But all of them, there's this element of reassuring the buyer by being less adventurous than 5 or 6 years ago. Even Phillips is becoming a little bit more
safe.
And the market is also playing safe, because you will have to go to number 20 in our... We are very proud of the top 100.
Well, it's an amazing achievement. That's just fascinating.
And also you can compare it from 1 year to another. We have the ranking of the various designers, the top selling designers at auction, and the evolution, you know, compared to the precedent.
Previous year.
The previous year. So the first contemporary one is Ron Arad. He's number 20. Let me see where he is.
Here we go. 31,
which is, you can see already this year he's number 31. He's a top contemporary selling designer. Last year he was 24. So already there is already a setback from last year.
And I found Zaha Hadid languishing at 97.
Yes.
Down from 66 the previous year.
Yes. And if we try to find Mark Newson. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Yeah. We don't have Mark Newson actually this year.
Really? So he's dropped out of the top 100 altogether?
So he didn't have any sales, basically.
Oh.
Barely had any sales.
So tell me, it's something like this.
Or maybe the sales didn't make it to over 100,000.
Right.
I don't think he did.
The Detank Market Report, obviously the auction houses will look at it, but the collectors look at it too?
The collectors definitely, yes. We sell it online on detank.com. And it's we have an equal number of collectors who purchase the report as professionals. I call them professional because it's museum directors, gallery dealers.
And do you think something like this has the power to actually influence the market going forward?
What I would say from in a few years' time might influence.
It's interesting because I see the
but no. In fact, it is. It might have the power to influence the market because of the trends that are mainly starting in this year, and if you look at the but it will definitely influence the market in its expansion.
Exactly. I suppose it's opening up information to people, and that always is beneficial for the market. And presumably it's also very helpful in terms of kind of estimating a price that might be fetched for a piece. Do you think it also will stop people who will go to an auction looking to buy a piece from bidding for a little bit more than they might have done if they weren't aware of the exact value of somebody's work in the previous year?
Yes, definitely. It can prevent them from bidding, overbidding, or also give them the tools to be confident in going for it and, going for a high price for the pieces because of, the trend of the designer in general or the information that they have in their hand.
You also, in the market report, have a series of essays which are very thought-provoking. One written by Edwin Heathcote that I enjoyed enormously. Is the idea then that this frames everything in a context rather than just being graphs and statistics? Sort of
exactly.
Gives a bit of humanity to all the findings.
It gives it. We try to be objective in the report and the number crunching. Numbers are numbers. So you can, and then you can also analyze them in an objective way. But also it gives a little bit of color and subjectivity. And also elements of reflection of what can the market be or develop. And we have this year the great privilege to have three writers who wrote three different articles.
The Rise of the Patron by Melanie Gerlis.
Yes.
Design After Ego, which was my favourite one by Edwin Heathcote, just because this is something that I have been increasingly frustrated by.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that suddenly the design speaks more than the person who made it.
Exactly. It is, in fact, and this is, in fact, another confirmation of, this little bit selective purchase that the collectors are doing for contemporary design is that you have a lot of branding and, the ego is too much involved in the piece and you want to collect a really beautiful piece of furniture that can last and have a longer longevity and its value and also pleasure to have and share. And the element of this very, actually, 1990s branding, megastar doing anything and selling it.
The rock star
is
designer.
Gone, yes, it's gone. And
good riddance.
Yeah.
That was me in Studio 2 with Rabi Hajj. And that, listeners, brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we're talking design, travel and transport. We'll be hearing from the Hamburg Aircraft Interiors Expo, visiting Globetrotter Luggage in London, and talking beautiful bikes in Chicago. So be sure to tune in then. Today's edition was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.